All right, this is Gary D'Amato, general sports columnist for the Journal Sentinel, here with, well, not here with Matt for the last kid. We're on opposite parts of the sides of the country. I'm in Kohler, Wisconsin, Matt. Are you in Portland?
I am in Portland. I got here earlier today, straight from Sacramento, where the Bucks refresh off a blowout of the Sacramento Kings. So getting ready for the last game of the road trip here coming up Thursday.
Yeah. Okay. So we're doing another Bucks podcast here through the miracle of Skype, and let's start right off by talking about the most recent two games the Bucks have played. Embarrassing loss to Utah on Saturday. They come back and look great against the Kings. What changed in a matter of 3 or 4 days there? What happened?
Well, I think against the Jazz, they were basically at the peak of their defensive struggles. Mm-hmm. They just really couldn't do anything against them. The Jazz are a team that runs more pick and roll than anybody else, and that's a set that the Bucks have already demonstrated this season that they have a lot of trouble dealing with. They really just got off on the wrong foot in terms of defending the three-point line. They got mixed up early. Guys, you know, lost their coverages, lost track of certain guys. I know Donovan Mitchell hit a couple early threes, and Joe Ingles hit one. Definitely guys you can't leave open, and the Jazz kind of just really got rolling from there. Ended up hitting a franchise record, 18 threes. After the game, Jason Kidd said that they just didn't play defense. There wasn't any effort, energy, care. He said sprinkle in a little trying. Just basically none of that was there. And then that's led to questions about the defensive scheme as a whole. You know, he's employed a really aggressive trapping defense for really the better part of the past 3 or 4 years, going back to when he was the head coach in Brooklyn. And so I'm sure we'll talk about that later. But over the 2 days that they had off, or, you know, Giannis Antetokounmpo made sure to say that they're not off days. You know, they were just days between games. You know, they practiced at UC Berkeley, kids, former school, where, you know, his number is retired, and they got after it. They really worked on their defensive principles about keeping their hands high, making sure that you, close off drives, hustle on defense, really kind of just shut things down at the point of attack, and everybody rotates it and moves on a string together, you know, after that. And then they also really put an emphasis on moving the ball. One of the issues for the Bucks against the Jazz was there were a lot of times where individual players, whether it was Giannis or Chris Middleton or Eric Bledsoe, you know, to a lesser extent Malcolm Brogdon, you know, even Tony Snell to an extent, you know, but he was making a shot, so it's not as bad. But guys just kind of started to go it alone. The ball wasn't moving. They weren't finding the right shot. And there was a lot of, you know, ball pounding, trying to back guys down and create on your own, as opposed to the kind of more open, free-flowing offensive ball movement that Kidd would prefer. And we saw all of those changes really kind of come together against the Kings. And granted, you know, the Kings aren't one of the better teams in the league. You know, they're not. They're a really, you know, young team with a couple really, you know, old, well-traveled veterans to kind of balance things out. They were coming off a back-to-back where they actually beat the Golden State Warriors without Steph Curry and without Kevin Durant. But, you know, they're a team that struggles a lot when it comes to turnovers and defense, and they don't shoot threes. They shoot the fewest threes per game and make the fewest threes per game of any team in the league. So this is kind of the perfect team for the Bucks to look really good against. And, you know, to Milwaukee's credit, that's what they did. I mean, they've had some issues with taking care of business against lesser teams. You know, case in point, the 32-point loss to the Dallas Mavericks earlier this month. Right. But, you know, they did exactly what they needed to do. Nobody had to play too many minutes, and they just cruised, and they looked great, and their defense was active, and I don't want to say always forcing turnovers, but they were getting turnovers because the Kings were making some head-scratching passes, but they were there to take advantage, and the offense looked good, and, you know, the bigger question will be when you're taking on a top-five defense in the NBA like they will be tomorrow night in Portland, can they do the same types of things? And so we'll have to see.
Yeah, you know, just going back to the Jazz game for a second, I watched the game, and I was just, a big part of it was that the Bucks didn't play defense, but I don't know that I've seen a team move the ball as quickly and efficiently as the Jazz did that night. I mean, I know they're a passing team. They're among they're one of the league leaders in number of passes per game in the NBA, but my goodness, the way they swung the ball around and consistently found a guy for an open shot. And then you looked at the other end, and the Bucks were exact opposites. Guys standing still, too much dribbling. Like you said, guys going one-on-one. If I was a coach, I'd put that tight tape in and say, here's how we want to play offense if you're an NBA team, and here's how we don't want to play offense. So to me, I mean, that might have been, I mean, that game and the Mavericks games, certainly the two worst games probably the Bucks have played this year. And, you know, you're going to have clunkers. I mean, as talented as these guys are, they're going to have off nights, and they certainly had a bad night. But, you know, it was encouraging that they bounced back. But, you know, where do they go from here? Which team are they? They seem to, you know, some nights they look like they can beat anybody in the NBA and can. And the next night, two nights later, they're losing by 30 points to a team that they should mop the floor with. So it's kind of a schizophrenic team right now, and I guess we have to wait and see how it all shakes out. But if you were to guess at the end of this in another 30 or 40 or 50 games down the road, where are they going to be as a team? What would you say?
You know, I think you're right. They're definitely, you know, kind of an up-and-down, inconsistent team. That they've been battling that for might as well just say years, you know, and that's something that they're going to have to figure out. You need that daily buy-in. You need that, you know, that mental toughness and focus to say, all right, I know that maybe we're down by a few points, you know, and I want to go for it on my own, but like we need to just stick to the offensive principle, stick to the plan, move the ball, get a good shot, drive when the lane is open, you know, just to make sound decisions instead of, you know, kind of just attacking and falling into a kind of stagnant offense. You know, but I think that they're gonna figure it out. I think as much as the defensive scheme has come into question, I think that there have also been times where it has worked. Not that it always will, and not that it's the best scheme in the world, but I think it's fair to say that there have definitely been games in which it's worked, in which the length and athleticism of the Bucks has kind of won out, and that they've been able to create turnovers and capitalize on them. So, you know, I'm really interested to see what happens when Jabari Parker comes back and how the defense fares, because, you know, if Jabari is what he has been in the past, and so far in practice he looks, you know, like he has the ability to get back to that point, if not exceed it, their offense is going to be fine. And that's one of the things that Jason Kidd said recently, is that this league is basically about who can hit the most three-pointers and score the most points. Because, right. You know, in his estimation, nobody's figured out how to stop three-pointers. You know, Grant, not everybody's shooting 40% from three like they are against the Bucks right now, which is the worst mark in the NBA and kind of is one of the more damning aspects of the defense that Kidd has put out there so far. And but, you know, they're... teams are making it a high clip, and that's a shot they want to take and they want to shoot. So if the Bucks can add to their offense, which is already, you know, especially their starting unit is one of the top units offensively in the NBA, if they can add to that and be able to bolster their bench regardless of who moves to the bench whenever Jabari Parker comes back, you know, they could have an offensive force that can kind of weather some of their defensive issues. You kind of have to figure out, you know, where you're going to kind of put all your eggs in the basket, and you know, offense seems to be something that, you know, if you can get Giannis going and Jabari going, and you have options with Bledsoe and Middleton, and Snell can hit, you know, open threes at a good clip, and then, you know, Thon Maker showing a consistency with his jump shot, and John Henson is just there for cleanup duty and easy dunks. So we'll have to see what they end up being, but I think that their offense as a whole is in a position where it's good now, has room to improve, and there are realistic ways in which it can improve.
You know, Matt, I thought it was really interesting the Q&A you had with Coach with Jason, and talking about their defensive shortcomings and some of the things they've been exposed on, which goes back a long time, obviously. And one of the things Jason said really struck me, that he's, you know, they assemble the length, the long athletic team that they've wanted, that they've always talked about, getting these guys who are long. These guys are lanky. And from that standpoint, it's great to have that, be able to deflect passes and clog lanes and that sort of thing and protect the rim. But on the other hand, Jason said, and I think it's so true, that length doesn't equate to quickness. The Bucks really don't have any super quick guys other than Eric Bledsoe now. And they don't have a bunch of guys running around who are super quick. They've got the length. They've got the athleticism. But, it's all about moving your feet on defense. And the question that is raised then is, can these guys consistently move their feet fast enough to stay with the really quick players in the NBA? And I think the jury's still out on that one, don't you?
Yeah, I think the jury's definitely out. And, you know, I don't know how much you can improve your foot quickness and foot speed, you know, in the middle of a season. Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with understanding the guys that you're playing, knowing their tendencies, which ways they like to go, what types of sets that their team runs, when they have the ball, when they're off the ball, if you get switched onto them and they consider that a mismatch, how you position yourself to put yourself into the best spot, making sure that if there is a pick and roll situation that, you know, the big or whoever is defending the screener is calling that out, you know, and trying to, you know, hedge as much as necessary in order to stop the drive from getting into the lane while also, you know, having the fill guy come behind him, and then kind of moving based on that. So defending the pick and roll has been huge, something that the Bucks have struggled with, and they're going to have to start figuring out. And, you know, you would hope that, obviously, you can't, you know, increase your foot speed that much, I don't think, during the season. But if you can understand where guys are coming from, where guys are going, and what teams are trying to do, and if you can stay, you know, focused on that in the heat of the game, then maybe you can put yourself into a better position to handle it and not need as much help from behind you and not right. kind of compromise the defense, so that suddenly guys are scrambling all over the place and then boom, wide open corner three, you know, and then you have to kind of try and adjust and figure it out the next time.
Right. Good point. Hey, I want to talk about something else that happened recently within the last week, and that's Giannis and Sean Sweeney having a little argument on the bench, caught on television. What do you make of that, Matt? Is there anything to read into that, or was it just a heat-of-the-moment thing between competitive guys? We all know how badly Giannis wants to win. I mean, you can see it all over his face. The guy wants to win basketball games and doesn't like to lose. And so was this one of those things that just it flared up, forgotten, and might never happen again? Or is there something deeper there?
You know, I don't think there's anything deeper there. I think you said it. Giannis is incredibly competitive. Sweeney's incredibly competitive. They are very good friends, and they have been the whole time that Sweeney's been here. He came with Jason Kidd in 2014. And they've been really close. You know, they watch a ton of film together, spend time off the court together. Whenever Giannis wants to go to the court, no matter what time of day it is, you know, you're likely to find Sweeney there. I mean, and these guys, you know, they have an understanding as to how they operate. You know, it's probably not the same way that you and I operate or how we interact with, you know, our boss or anything like that, but That's the way it is for them. And Giannis, you know, and Sweeney to an extent too, kind of just laughed it off the next day. Like, you know, that's just who we are. You know, we're brothers. Brothers fight. You know, the only difference now is that you guys saw it. It's not like it hasn't happened before. You know, and that was kind of my thought when I first saw it, just knowing the background of Giannis and Sweeney. And you have to kind of think about the context too, because I'm pretty sure. But right before that happened, Giannis thought he got fouled going for a layup, and then he can't kind of was slow on defense or slow getting back, and then he, you know, committed a turnover. All those things were kind of happening around the same time, and so the end result was Utah getting an easy layup, and, you know, Jason Kidd calls timeout. I think it tied the score. And that's when Giannis came off, already frustrated, already a little bit moody. And Sweeney said something to him, which hasn't been disclosed, but, you know, you can kind of get an idea based on the video, said something to him. You know, and it could have been something as simple as, hey, you need to play better. You know, you can't get frustrated or whatever it was. You know, probably in not so many words as I put it. And Giannis responded to that with some frustration. And that's what we all saw. And it doesn't look good when you have the star of your team yelling at an assistant coach like that. I've kind of just took it at face value. That doesn't look good. I think knowing the background between the two of them, definitely adds a little bit of a layer to it, a layer for understanding. Then you also think about it as if there was really an issue, if Giannis is yelling, I'm going to F you up, and is actually incensed and does not like that coach and can't work with that coach and actually wants to fight him, he'd be gone already.
Yeah.
You know, sure. We saw that with Fizdale in Memphis, you know, where he had an issue, you know, he had ongoing issues with Marc Gasol. He's the star. Marc Gasol is the star of that team. And, you know, those tensions kind of came to a head when Fizdale sat him for, you know, the end of the Grizzlies game against the Nets, their eighth straight loss. And on Monday, you know, the next day, Fizdale was gone. You know,
right.
And so, you know, this definitely, you know, the NBA is a league that caters to the stars. You know, if a star wants something, doesn't want something, needs a change, needs some kind of adjustment, like, that's probably going to happen because teams are invested in those stars. Those stars are in limited quantity, and, you know, they want to do things to make sure that they stay, to make sure that they are playing at their best, and make sure that they're happy. And coaches, you can find anywhere. Not that all of them are created equal, but you can find a guy to coach your team. And so if there's an issue between a player and a coach, and if it's real, then that pretty much is creating a ticking time bomb for that coach. You know, so long story short, I think the Giannis Sweeney thing is basically a non-issue. They've said it's a non-issue, and I don't doubt them. I think this is just a look into what their relationship is like. And while that's not a normal relationship for people with normal jobs, I don't think that this is a totally unusual relationship, or that kind of language is necessarily unusual for people who are in high-level professional athletics. I mean, what do you think about that, Gary?
Yeah, you know, I agree with everything you said there, and just going back to Giannis too, I think it shows that Giannis has some growing to do, because he's a guy who wears his emotions on his sleeve. Certainly, I think he's, to me, on the outside looking in, and I'm not around the team like you are, Matt, but it looks like he can still be a little too easily frustrated on the court. I think things get under his skin a little bit, and he might not show it in the most, or handle it in the most mature manner. And I've seen a few occasions this year. You talked about him, you know, thinking he got fouled, maybe not getting back on defense. I've seen that happen a few times this year. Not that he's not a hustler, because he is. Not that he doesn't work hard, because he certainly does. Not saying anything like that. I'm just saying I think he's young, and I think frustration every occasionally gets the best of him. And I think I agree with you. I think that's all this probably was in this instance. Wouldn't you say so?
Oh, yeah. And you know, we've seen a few times this season where things haven't been going his way, and he becomes one of those ball pounders, one of those guys who just says, all right, let me just take over, and let me just go attack the rim and try and, you know, cut down this deficit myself, you know, and that has worked. But there have also been times where, you know, he tries to do a little bit too much, the offense stagnates, or he commits just a silly offensive foul where, you know, I can see from, you know, wherever I'm sitting, and it's not always the closest spot, you know, I can see that the defender is just setting him up so that, you know, okay, bump, all right, just wait for that big shoulder, take it, offensive foul.
Right.
And, you know, I think I looked it up recently, I think he has about 17 or 18 offensive fouls this season. You know, and some of those are just kind of the nature of how things are. Sometimes when you're a guy who drives the lane and everyone knows that's what you want to do, you're going to get a couple offensive fouls. But, you know, a pretty good chunk of those have been situations where he's either been frustrated or has been trying to do maybe a little bit too much on his own, and it's kind of just pounding the ball, attack, you know, backing somebody down and just kind of setting him up with that shoulder. And that's something that he's got to cut down on. And I'm sure, you know, that's been brought to his attention. But I think you're right in pointing out that he does have some growing to do. And, you know, when you're a superstar in this league, it's people take notice if you're yelling at and cussing out one of your coaches on the sideline. You know, it's a lot different than if, you know, the eighth guy off the bench is doing it. And so it becomes more of an issue because it's you. And so while they say that that's something that's happened, they have their blow-ups, they speak truth to each other, and, you know, they have an understanding and a relationship where that's allowed, and they can grow from that, and nothing lingers. You do have to think about the PR implications, right? And just the way that looks and the way that affects, you know, the team in your teammates and the way that people think about you. So, you know, this could be a learning experience.
How did he handle it when you and or other reporters asked him about it? Was he up front? Did he explain it or was he trying to dodge questions? Was he trying to not answer questions about it, or was he just up front and said, "Hey, look, this is what happened, and we're over it, and that's that."
Oh, he was just straight up with it. And he kind of just smiled and was very relaxed about it. You know, it just wasn't an issue to him. It was kind of something where he knew that it was becoming a thing, and mm-hmm. he kind of just like smiled and laughed and talked it off, not treating it too lightly, but at the same time, it wasn't something that was on his mind. You know, I was getting him after practice, you know, where, you know, he and Thon Maker and Sean Sweeney spent upwards of 30 minutes, at least while I was there, you know, working together and talking together and being absolutely fine. You know, and while we were talking, you know, Giannis pointed to Sweeney, who was, you know, a little bit of ways across the gym, and Sweeney was watching us, and he was smiling, basically just taking joy in the fact that Giannis had to talk about all this. And, you know, in the time that I've been around the Bucks, you know, it's probably been a handful of times that Giannis has mentioned, oh yeah, you know, Sweeney doesn't smile. Like, he's never happy. You know, he's just the coach who keeps pushing and wants more and wants you to be better. And so, you know, he's the defensive coach. So, you know, there have been games where Giannis has done some positive things on defense, and, you know, people have asked, oh, hey, that makes Sweeney happy. He's like, oh, Sweeney's never happy. He doesn't smile. You know, so him pointing out that Sweeney's, you know, watching us, you know, go through the kind of song and dance of asking him about their altercation and what happened, it kind of gives you a little bit of a lens into kind of how they were kind of having fun with it.
Let's talk about the schedule coming up, Matt, a little bit, and then maybe we can take some questions from Twitter. But you got Portland, basically, right, tomorrow?
Yep, on Thursday night.
Yeah, and then they come home and play the Kings again Saturday, right?
Yes, they do, and then they're out to Boston for, you know, a as always, tough game against the Celtics, which have been, you know, playing well to start the season. And then we'll finally get some games at the Bradley Center, like, in a row, which is kind of strange, especially since I've been gone for so long. They have Detroit on December 6th, the Mavericks for a revenge game on December 8th, and then another revenge game with the Jazz coming in on December 9th.
All right, look, why don't we swing over and... I think we've got some questions on Twitter that have popped up, right? Why don't we try to answer a couple of those before we sign off?
All right, sounds good. Just a few. I mentioned to people that they could ask non-basketball questions, so we'll probably get a couple of those in. But, you know, one of the questions, I think the only Bucks-related question I'm seeing right now, I guess I was too late in putting out this call for questions, but somebody asked, you know, how hot is Jason Kidd's seat? And that's something that's been a popular topic on Twitter among the fan base. You know, there's a lot of people with the hashtag FireKid logo as their Twitter photo. I don't know who put that together, but it's becoming pretty popular. And I would say that right now I don't think it's that hot. I think when you look at where they are this season. It's maybe a little bit lower record-wise than you might expect, but I think that he hasn't lost the players. He hasn't lost Giannis, and as I mentioned, the Superstar League, and he still has their attention. He still has kind of their belief, at least from all the conversations that I've had with players in the locker room, in good times and bad. I think that, you know, they have a, when I've talked to John Horst, just overall, you know, he's talked about making decisions that are not reactive. And, you know, heading into the season, the ownership had only, you know, high praise and belief in what Kidd could do with this team. John Horst joined them in that regard. And I don't think that 19 games into the season with a 10-9 record and in a position where, you know, they could reasonably finish at where, at a spot where they're expected to finish, which would be, you know, somewhere north of 45 wins. I think all of that's still on the table. And so, not that, you know, that it'd be inconceivable for any, for Kidd to be gone, because obviously, you know, you can make the argument that he's underachieved with the players that he has. His defensive scheme has not improved over time, and that maybe the players have not improved to the extent that, that maybe they should, and all of those are reasonable, arguments. But I think just with the Bledsoe trade and having to integrate him and, you know, get this team ready for, you know, he likes to call it the marathon of the season. That's kind of just the thing he always points to. You know, the small sample size, yeah, it's a quarter of the season, so it's not that small, but them being 10-9 at this point isn't as damning as I think, a very loud portion of Twitter, would like it to seem. You know, if they were five games under 500 right now, I'd have a very different answer. You know, if they were, you know, if they lost to the Kings last night, I would have a very different answer. You know, because losing to the Kings and losing to the Mavericks in a couple weeks, not pretty. You know,
not good. Yeah.
And you know, and so some people might argue that, you know, it shouldn't be about the wins and losses. It should be just, is this person the best person for the job? And if they're not, and you can get somebody better, then you should. But I don't know that right now, if they were going to get rid of Jason Kidd tomorrow, that they could, you know, put somebody in that would be able to get immediate results that would be better. Maybe they'd be able to get long-term results that were better. But that, you know, they're trying to win right now. I mean, they're trying to build a team that can be competitive in the Eastern Conference right now. And I don't know if making a coaching change at this current juncture would, you know, continue that goal for this season. That doesn't mean that his job is safe forever. You know, obviously there's expectations for this team and they need to reach them. So we can revisit that later this season. If they have a massive losing streak and, you know, guys are healthy and they should be doing much better than they are, then that season's gonna get hot because, you know, they have a growth mentality. And so far, you could say, okay, his first season, they overperformed. The next season, when they missed the playoffs, they kind of corrected and kind of regressed to the mean a little bit. And then their third season, they moved back up a little bit. They got above 500. And, you know, they had a competitive playoff series. And now that's the bottom, like, of what they should be. They should at the very least be a team that is in the playoffs and competitive. And the next step beyond that is to be a higher ranked seed in the playoffs and not just be competitive, but get out of the first round for the first time in 16 years. So I think there's still some more time, before anything changes, but, you know, the results will probably dictate how long that is.
Yeah, that's a very reasoned, rational answer. And the way I look at it is, I think some of the frustration on the fans' part is not that they're necessarily 10-9 and they should be, you know, 15-5 or whatever, but it's the fact that of those nine losses, you know, three or four of them have been really, really ugly. And I think that's when fans get frustrated, is when they watch this team that was hyped quite a bit, has a superstar, and is supposed to be growing, is supposed to be getting better and better, and they see this team lay an egg on some nights. that doesn't look pretty. And I think that's what gets people so frustrated, is that they think that, you know, if these losses were by 3 points to good teams and they had 9 losses, I think people would be looking at it a little differently. But I'm with you. I think it's way too early. They just made the Bledsoe trade. You know, they don't have Jabari. They're going to get him back. But I would say, Matt, that if they're 3 games under 500 at the end of January, say, as you say, I think then you have to reconsider and look at everything again. I don't think they, in my opinion, they can't be a team that's going to muddle around until they get Jabari back and use that as an excuse. You're right. They have to win now. They're not going to win big. They're not going to win 55 games. They're not that good a team. But there's no reason that they can't win, you know, 45, 46 games and improve as the season goes along. And I think that's what we're going to be looking for in December, January, and February, in my opinion.
Yeah, and they have, you know, a schedule where they can make that happen. I mean, this game against Portland on Thursday is going to be a tough one. It's a tough place to win for anybody. But then they have the Kings, which, you know, no matter what happens on Thursday, they should have no problem beating the Kings again. That's not a team that should give them any trouble. Then they head to Boston, and that's a good measuring stick. It's a place they've won before. And, you know, they need to be playing at their best to be able to compete in that game. And then that 3-game homestand, I mean, they've proven that they can beat the Pistons, you know, a team that's gotten off to a strong start and has really surprised some people. But, you know, they're 1-1 against the Pistons this year. They beat them at the Bradley Center. That's a game that's certainly winnable. The back-to-back that weekend on the Friday and Saturday against the Mavericks and Jazz, you know, those are two that you should pick up. There should be a correction from both of those previous games. And obviously, you don't come out underestimating those teams after you've lost to them. So, I mean, the Bucks should be putting forward their best effort to kind of claim those wins. And, you know, then you kind of go from there. I mean, you have the Pelicans, who have been tough. The Bulls, a team that the Bucks should beat 4 times this year. I don't know why they wouldn't beat them 4 times. you know, a test against the Rockets in Houston, a test against the Cavaliers at home, and then a couple games against the Hornets, which, you know, they haven't. They've you know, they split the Hornets so far this year. That's a team that the Bucks should beat. I would say those 2 times in December, and then you're heading towards the new year, and you know some. You know, the schedule kind of goes on from there. But I think that if the Bucks can take advantage of being back home and win those games when they have the opportunity in front of the home crowd and pick up a couple wins on the road, then they'll get back to where they are kind of expected to be. And part of it with a team that is expected to be, you know, maybe have 45 wins, you know, that's like 8 games over 500. So if you're hanging around like, you know, 2, 3, 4 games over 500 at any point in the season, you know, you're setting yourself up to, you know, you're just 1 win streak away from being where you need to be. You're also 1 losing streak away from where you don't want to be. So, you know, I think in the ideal world, you know, for the fans, they would like the Bucks to be, you know, as many games over 500 as early as possible and then kind of take your chances after that. But yeah, I kind of expect that, you know, 500 should be the minimum. You know, that I don't think they're going to be too far under 500 at any point this year. 500 should be the minimum, and then you have to just grow from there. And if they're going to hover there, the question is, how long do you hover there before that becomes an issue? Because if you're just trading wins back and forth, you know, that's not going to get you too far. But if you can, you know, weather some tougher games, maybe steal 1 or 2 here or there, and then just take advantage of the schedule whenever you get the opportunity to string together wins, then you can set your stuff up. And when Jabari Parker comes back, it'll be really interesting, like I said, to see how far they can go and how high he can push them, because when you have another weapon like Jabari Parker, I mean, it should make your team, you know, that much harder to handle on the offensive end.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Matt. This team was is really marketed well by the Bucks. They've done a great job marketing this team, creating a buzz about it. The city is, I hear more talk about the Bucks than I've heard in years in this city. And you have to start to wonder, I mean, was the team oversold, or is it too early to make that sort of statement?
I think it's too early. I mean, they kind of sold themselves in the sense that they have the same team they had last year, and Giannis is still as good as advertised and one of the most entertaining players in the NBA, and one of the most efficient players in the NBA. So, I mean, they still have that exciting group. And the general expectation, without them even having to sell it, is that if you bring back the same team, that team should get better. Because other teams are going to get worse, and that team, by being together, is supposed to build chemistry, and is supposed to just know how to play together better and just build off of what they already had. And, you know, so far, we haven't seen that from them. They've still had some of the same lapses as in years past, some of the same struggles on the offensive end as in years past. You know, and some of that you can kind of attribute to the Bledsoe trade. But at the same time, I mean, Bledsoe came in, they won four straight games and seemed like they were adjusting quickly. And then they had that kind of belated adjustment period, where they, you know, started to struggle and strung losses together and looked kind of out of sorts. So, I don't think they were oversold. They set the bar themselves. And so if they fail to reach that bar, I think that that's kind of something that looks, you know, looks poorly for them, you know, for the team, not that they were oversold.
Right. All right. What else? Any other questions sitting around?
I do have some questions, though. They're more of the golf variety for you. Esteemed Journal Sentinel intern or former intern Alec Lewis wants your take on Tiger Woods' return.
Ah, good question. Yeah, tomorrow, the Hero World Challenge down in the Bahamas. Look, I'm as excited as anybody about to see what Tiger's going to do with this latest comeback attempt. All signs are that he's feeling better than he's felt in years. He's been saying it now for weeks. Guys he's played practice rounds with have said he's hitting it as long as he's ever hit it. He looks great. But I kind of temper that a little bit because we've heard this similar talk before when he's come back from other back surgeries and, you know, he plays two rounds of golf and starts limping and grabbing his back. And next thing you know, he's having another surgery. I don't think, you know, we're not going to know. I mean, this is going to be a good first test, but it's an 18-player field. There's no cut. There's no pressure to speak of. The only pressure on Tiger is just all eyes are going to be on him to see what he does. But, I mean, he can – like last year he played in this, he led the field in birdies, but he also made a ton of bogeys. So I'm anxious and interested to see what he does. I don't put too much stock in this week. I'm just looking forward to when he comes back on tour and starts playing tour regularly in, you know, tournament conditions where every shot really means something. But I'm excited. I mean, Tiger Woods coming back at 70% of what he was. If he can, you know, get in the mix with some of these young kids, Jordan Spieth and Rory McIlroy and Dustin Johnson, I think golf is in a really, really good place because it'll be exciting to see what he's going to be 42 in a couple weeks, and definitely not over the hill age wise, but his body's been through a lot. So yeah, I'm really excited to see what he can do. I have no idea, and I'm anxious to watch.
All right, then we have one more golf question for you. From Eric Benning. He wanted to know, what are some of the lesser known golf courses in Wisconsin that you're fond of? For me, the answer is easy. I don't know any of them. So I guess I'm either fond of all of them or I'm not fond of all of them.
Oh, you should probably just answer that question. Wisconsin is becoming a mecca for golf. Look, there's all these new courses that have been built in the last 20 years, and now Sand Valley is going up near Wisconsin Rapids, fabulous resort. There's two 18-hole courses there now and a short course, and that's going to be a worldwide golfing destination, just like Kohler is with the Black Wolf Run and Whistling Straits. But when you talk about out-of-the-way courses, Wisconsin has 540 golf courses, roughly, and, you know, probably 300 of them are sort of mom and pop out of the way courses that cost between $20 and $30 to play. And there's out of that bunch, there's really a lot of fun, good golf courses. There's a little place near McGuanago called Eagle Springs, a little 9-hole course that was built like in 1902. It's such a blast to play. It's so quirky. Some of these courses, Twin Lakes, down in Kenosha County, Spring Valley down near Antioch, Illinois, just over the border. they're courses that were built 70, 80, 90 years ago. And so they're, you wouldn't build courses like that today, but they're just a blast to play. And, all you got to do is look around and you can find pretty good golf courses in Wisconsin in the $20 to $35 range that not a lot of people know about.
All right. Well, I guess I have a question for you, Gary. Have you ever been to Portland or Boston?
I've been to Boston several times. I went to Portland once to cover U.S. Women's Open the year before the U.S. Women's Open came to Black Wolf Run in 1998. I was in Portland at a course called Pumpkin Ridge, in 1997. And that's the only time I've ever been in Portland. So I can't recommend any good restaurants for you. Sorry about that.
That's what I'm angling for, because that's, that's my next stop after we're done here. And then my next road trip with the Bucks is in Boston, which I've been to a couple times, but there's always more restaurants to try. Always good places to go. So if any listeners listen to this on Thursday morning or late Wednesday night and you want to, you know, let me know all the great places in Portland. I've already hit up Voodoo Donuts and that was a great decision. So if there's anybody who has good ideas, I'm always interested in those during this this life on the road. And so yeah, I think that's all we got, right, Gary?
Yeah, it sounds like we're nearing the end here. Matt, you're doing a great job, and hopefully you haven't hit the wall yet. Just got a long way to go. So hang in there, and we'll be doing another podcast very soon. But until then, we'll sign out, and thanks for listening.